Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this edition of City Talks. Today, my guest is Neil O'Brien. Neil is MP for Harborough, Oadby and Wigston in the Leicestershire area. He's also a formal special advisor to the PM, Theresa May, and to the former Chancellor, George Osborne. He's the author of many reports, the latest one being Firing on All Cylinders, Building a Strong Economy from the Bottom Up, which was published by Onward, of which Neil is also a member of the advisory board. Neil, welcome to City Talks.
Thank you.
So we're going to talk about the report and the sort of thinking in it and your thinking in it. But before we do that, you know, you've had a kind of long history of being involved in questions about building an economy for everyone. You were instrumental in the Northern Powerhouse, kind of questions about the north-south nature of the British economy. Just say, you know, where does that come from? Where does that commitment and involvement come from?
It comes from two different places. It partly comes from where I'm from. So I grew up in Huddersfield, and that has definitely framed the way I think about politics. But it also comes from contemporary policy discussion, where questions about economic geography have become central, and that whole area has become much more studied. And it's become increasingly clear that one of the UK economy's main problems is its geographical imbalances. Let's just take housing for a second. What have these cities got in common? Glasgow, Newcastle, Liverpool, Middlesbrough, Sunderland, Hull and Dundee. They are all cities that had a smaller population in 2016 than they did in 1981. And at the same time, this is a country with a massive housing crisis. And yet you've got all these cities that are great cities that are smaller than they used to be. And that is a nice example of the problems of an unbalanced economy, because you are forced as a government to spend more and more trying to cope with the problems of growth, the congestion, the housing shortages, and so on and so forth, at the same time as you have these tremendous cold patches in the economy where supply, demand rather, is not enough to stimulate supply, in some cases in housing, where you have underused resources, roads that are not at capacity, you have all kinds of problems matching people to job opportunities. So it's become increasingly apparent that the problem of an unbalanced economy is something that's holding the UK back. And in one of my more recent reports, I pointed out that there are no large economies that are richer per head than Britain and have a more geographically unbalanced economy. All the countries that have a more geographically unbalanced economy are poorer than us. And so I think that brings home to me the centrality of that, that problem of imbalances and the opportunity, really, that that creates, because you have underused resources in some places, you have overheating in others, and you know, you've got a problem in one place and a solution in another.
But your ethos, I suppose, and your approach is about, and you talk about it in this report and you've talked about it elsewhere, is about very crudely kind of levelling up rather than levelling down. You know, in a sense, we want to do more with places outside of the greater southeast, but not necessarily to actively constrain or lower output or productivity or activity in those places that are doing reasonably well already.
Absolutely. So it would be extremely unwise to try and level down, and I think the politics of it wouldn't work. I'm not sure what it would even mean. I mean, there are only a few examples of policies that we've ever had since the Second World War that have that kind of levelling down quality. There was an attempt, for example, in Birmingham and in London after the war to deliberately restrict the growth of both industrial companies and also offices to try, in the belief that if you just stop development in those booming places, it would automatically flow to somewhere else. But actually, we now know it was very clear that actually we just lost a lot of growth, and some of it went to other countries, and you didn't really see any meaningful shifting of that activity to other places. If you look back at those post-war policies, the ones that were much more successful were ones where we created tax incentives or the capital incentives like grants to try and get high productivity, high knowledge, high capital investment jobs to move to areas that were lagging. And sometimes the way that things played out was very circuitous, or certainly not what policymakers thought would happen. So, for example, in 60s, Dundee's jute industry was in rapid decline. Everyone always talks about Dundee is famous for jute jam and journalism.
Indeed.
And the jute industry was definitely on the way out in the 60s. And so the government gave a capital grant to Timex to try and get them to come and make watches, I think, up in Dundee. And that worked. And so the bribe to them effectively got them to invest there. And that made it easier to invest in new factory equipment up there. And because that had that factory, by the 1980s, that was coming to a sort of an end. So it was decided to build, you might remember this from your childhood as well, the ZX Spectrum, cool computer, personal computer of the 80s. And because that was built there, for various reasons, every kid in town had one. It was always said that they were falling off the back of a lorry. I don't know if that's true or not. I don't want to slight the people of Dundee here, but everyone had one. As a result, there were a lot of computer games companies founded there. One particularly did well, and that led the local university. They had the bright brainwave to create the first computer games course in the world, and then that caused much more people to many more firms to seed there. And Dundee has outperformed the national average as a result, partly of that strong sector there. And that's all come about as a surprising result of that 1960s decision to try and get some high productivity, high capital investment, private investment into that part of the country to fight decline.
And we'll come to this in a second, and that's part of your kind of argument, I suppose, in trying to think about how we incentivize and stimulate firm activity in different places, particularly outside of London, often using the tax system to do that. And particularly, you're a big fan of a kind of international or inward investment from overseas for a bunch of economic reasons. But in a sense, interestingly, I wonder whether at the time when the decision to encourage Timex into Dundee, whether how that would then play out was a part of the thinking. Because I suppose my counter would be, lots of investment in different sorts into the South Wales area over the 70s and 80s, particularly international investors, which when you look back now, don't seem to have had a kind of a longevity or a legacy to their sort of investments, been and gone. It's very much a sort of, but just your thinking on that. Do we know what we're doing when we do these sorts of things? Should we worry too much about it?
So we know what we're doing to some extent, and we can look back at many, many decades now of what has worked and what has worked less well. I mean, it's always difficult to know exactly what the counterfactual would have been for any area. If you say things didn't make it a miraculous economic powerhouse, well, it could have been much worse in the absence of any intervention. If you've ever seen the film Requiem for Detroit, an amazing film just looking at the ruins of a formerly great city. And in the UK, we don't have anything like that. We've never allowed a city to completely go bankrupt and just be really effectively utterly destroyed, where every single building is pulled down. Instead, what we get in countries like the UK that are more, you could say, sort of slightly more social democratic, certainly more kind of welfare state-y, is you end up with places that just get kind of stuck and they lag behind and they're poorer and have higher rates of unemployment than other parts of the country for a long time. And people don't move. In a sort of some sort of libertarian textbook world, maybe people just move when there's no jobs there anymore, but in the real world people don't, because particularly unskilled people or lower skilled people or poorer people are less likely to move away from their friends and family. They need their friends and family more. They can't just go out and buy childcare. They need to rely on their family circle to provide it, for example. And so people are kind of stuck. If the jobs are anywhere near them, it doesn't have to be in their neighborhood, doesn't have to be in their town, but if there are no good jobs or ready supply of decent jobs near them, then you get this problem of labor market mismatching, and you don't get those rates of unemployment coming down to the levels you want to see. So sorry, I've come slightly off of answering your question. Do we know what works in these places? I think one of the things that we need to be wary about is things which incentivize low wage employment to move to poor places. So if you look back at 50s, 60s, 70s policies, if you provided effectively tax breaks for employing people or for employing kind of lower wage labour, then you get kind of short-term positive hit. You soak up some unemployment, but in the long term, you're actually locking those areas into further dependence on low skill employment. The things that work better are where we either gave tax breaks or capital subsidies, effectively just grants to buy equipment to companies, because there you're not specific to low wage employment. And in fact, if you're incentivizing capital intensive businesses with lots of machinery or lots of ideas, then you're generally incentivizing the provision of really good employment. Mm. And those are the schemes that worked better. And then looking a bit further forward in time, looking more to kind of schemes like in the 80s and 90s now, things that work well are things where the government has tried to play a catalytic role and kind of unlocked things and fragmentation that have been holding back development. So if you think about Docklands in Liverpool and London in the 1980s, you had large areas of land in important cities in the hands of loads of different bodies, including lots of different public sector bodies, and nothing could be done because there wasn't a sort of critical mass. And so Michael Heseltine, Mrs. Thatcher, the creation of those development corporations, you consolidated all that land, you put in the new infrastructure like the DLR in London, the provision of new cultural institutions in Liverpool, and you created a critical mass for regeneration. And now obviously Docklands in London is part of the financial capital of Europe, really. And in Liverpool, that was start of the centre of Liverpool's regeneration journey, really. And so those kind of things, I think, are very effective, or can be very effective if you do them right. Mm. And it's not the government doing things, you're not moving public sector jobs there, you're kind of unlocking or clearing the way for private sector growth. Because, you know, if you look at the excellent work of the Centre for Cities, you know, you can see that not all jobs are the same. If you can get private sector jobs to an area, that has a much bigger multiplier effect than public sector jobs. And if you can get the investment from high skill, high capital, high knowledge types of employers, then that has an even bigger multiplier effect. The new geography of jobs, which is a book that an awful lot of people who are interested in these things have been interested in the last couple of years, by Moretti, really sort of brings it home to you how where places have turned themselves around or prospered, it's often been led by investment from really high skill companies. And sometimes the origins of those investments are not the result of any kind of policy maker's decision. They're often arbitrary. So Moretti has a good parable about how Seattle, which was on its absolute knees in the 70s, the last person in Seattle, please turn out the lights, adverts and things like that. Through pure luck, it happens that Bill Gates' dad was living there, because it had good industries in the past. Because he was living there, he went home, started Microsoft there, it grew because it had Microsoft. Then, you know, in the 90s when Jeff Bezos was, you know, starting this thing, Amazon, which, you know, speculative business about selling books. Well, you know, there were a lot of software engineers there, and so that's another good reason to move up there. And then that also became massive, and he's obviously investing in space in the area, and one thing leads to another. And there are similar stories to tell in the UK as well. I mean, often the story about the Cambridge cluster gets very hung up on, oh, no, it's all about having this great university. And some of the origins of it are in the university and some businesses that spun out of the university. But a lot more of it is just sort of self-sustaining. And there's all these businesses that spun off other businesses and a whole sort of soup of entrepreneurs going round and round starting different businesses. And one thing leads to another. And if you can get that sort of virtuous cycle going in an industry or two in different places, then I think that is probably the single most important thing you could do for regeneration. I suppose if people are going to take away a message from the report that I did most recently, Firing on All Cylinders, about growth, as well as just the importance of having an approach to rebalancing the economy, it would be, you know, so often policymakers, when they think about how are we going to get poorer cities, towns, regions growing, they think, right, we're going to, you know, what tram are we going to do? What capital investment in transport infrastructure are we going to make? Mm. Or can we move some public sector jobs there? Or something like that. And I would say start your search at how can we get knowledge-intensive private sector firms to come and make inward investments there, and what kind of assets do you have already in the area that can potentially attract them to do that?
Yeah.
So for example, in Leicestershire, through completely random history, you know, it happens that the university has a strong history in making small satellites. And it turns out that is a great growth industry at the moment. And they also have a good industry in earth observation. So, you know, if you want to buy weather data on ground observations. So if you were smart, the thing to invest in is things that help that little industry, which is such a knowledge-intensive industry, grow. And the same would be true of a lot of other places in the country. I mean, some places you've had these tremendous entrepreneurs like Sheffield University have done, not just their VC, but the whole institution have been brilliant at being a real catalyst for private inward investment in South Yorkshire, and it got Boeing in, all these other top-end employers to come there to draw on those industrial strengths that they've had before and their research strengths. And by the way, I mean, the universities get measured an awful lot on their research excellence and an awful lot on their teaching excellence, and the measure of, you know, their industrial impact, which is probably the most important thing for the Treasury. Yeah, you know, it's just not even a big, that's not even a big important measure for most universities. So there's lots you could do there to gear them up more to be doing more.
Is part of your sort of reflection that governments haven't been, or certainly need to be, more responsive and fleet of foot in first identifying, you know, those sorts of examples, whether it's Sheffield or whether it's Leicestershire, or, you know, or whether it's Cambridge, and then investing in them, or figuring out what needs to be supported from the government's point of view? Are there two aspects to that? Firstly, recognising, and B, doing something appropriate and supportive.
So I think there's two levels to look at it. From the sort of top-down point of view, I think central government needs to have, particularly post-Brexit, but anyway, a more activist approach to encouraging inward investment. And I think the state of the art here is really the Irish Inward Investment Agency. And I think we need, it's great that it's now a ministerial department. You've got Liam Fox there, who's a great guy. And what we need really to back that up is something to compete on tax. You know, most Asian economies, most US states, if you're going to make a big inward investment, a big capital investment, there are going to be all kinds of exciting tax breaks waiting for you. I mean, sometimes in the US this goes to ludicrous extents almost, but you know, if you're going to invest in most of those Asian economies, you would be expecting some kind of powerful tax incentive to do so, and we don't really have that in the UK. And if we had that, and if we were then also prepared to try and steer some of that towards areas that could particularly use it, then I think we'd have something really powerful. It's just not really part of the UK discussion. And so where there is a discussion already is more the kind of bottom-up stuff. So we have, you know, we had RDAs, we now have LEPs. They could be much more powerful institutions. They have a bit of a budget that we can both improve the way that's spent and probably also enlarge it. And they are really the people who should be doing the kind of bottom-up opportunity identifying thing. I mean, it's a really mixed picture in terms of the LEPs. Some of them are good, and occasionally they've had real hits, but some of them have produced an awful lot of analysis that hasn't gone anywhere, or they've just not been very effective. I suppose in different fields, different things are true. I think, for example, you take housing and kind of urban regeneration. I do think that you probably do need a more muscular approach from the centre, but you do also need to empower cities and towns and counties to do it for themselves, because I think I started by talking about the number of cities that have depopulated or not grown very fast. I don't think that we will solve that by just liberalising housing and planning, because we've kind of tried that. And if you're going to do more development in your cities, you need to, well, you can devolve power and you can liberalise building upwards and stuff like that, but you can't really regenerate cities unless you've got good public transport, because that's what enables density. So the devolution of buses, I think, is a really exciting thing. If that's not a nerdy sentence, you'll never hear one.
You hear it a lot in centre cities, as you know, you hear us a lot about that.
You at least,
but you're right. We're nerds together.
Then you can have much more dense development. You can do more in our cities, and you need to be able to give cities and counties and places outside the centre the ability to capture a lot more of the value that is created when development occurs. Or at the very least, to put it a different way, you've got to get developers to bear much more of the externalities, the infrastructure costs of new developments. At the moment, people are making absolutely jackpot profits from development, which tends to happen in a very piecemeal way, you know, bits and pieces stuck onto the edges of villages and towns and cities, but without significant new investments in either physical infrastructure like roads and public transport, or social infrastructure like GP surgeries and schools. And if we're going to do serious regeneration, we need to be able to make sure that the developers are paying for more of the costs that their developments bring about. And so I think that does involve giving local authorities in the UK and the centre the ability to do what most regional and local governments do in other developed countries, the powers that US states or German lender or French mayors have to buy chunks of land, prepare it for development, put in the infrastructure and the services, and then sell it off in a structured way at a much higher value, having captured that value for the community.
Yeah. And why, I mean, just on that, come back to some other things, but on that, why have we become so incredibly reluctant in this country to do precisely that? I mean, if you go back 40s, 50s and 60s, with the more recent, I suppose, new towns, you know, and we were essentially doing what you've just described, you know, acquiring land at, you know, a low cost, and then we were developing it out and in a sense selling it on, and all, which seemed to be normal practice. And yet now, you know, people talk about new towns, but you know, don't see much political movement on. I mean, why have we, politically, why have we become so reluctant in this space when the problem is so large?
I think the answer is the history. So it's partly that when we did very large new settlements and cities in the 50s and 60s, not all of them were a great success. We were building them at a time when concrete was in vogue, and a lot of them were built to house people with a lot of problems. So while some of them are very successful, like Milton Keynes, which is in a good place and is has a lot of private development in it and looks good, others, I'm not going to name them, are you know, heavily social housing in difficult places, built at a time when it was all about having, you know, shopping centres that look like concrete bunkers. So that sort of put people off in the idea of new towns, though people like the idea of garden villages. And I think for a long time there wasn't perceived to be a problem. You know, Britain's population was flatlining. There was no housing problem that anyone could see, and so there was no real interest in it. And now we're into a third phase where there is a massive housing problem, and there is huge amounts of demand, particularly in the southeast of the country. And in those high demand areas, pretty much every local authority, there's even the ones in Greenbelt, are having to plan for some kind of new settlement, normally described as a garden village. My local authority, my district local authority, are trying to do two at the moment in their local plan. In the district authority I used to live in, they were trying to do one. And so they are now into the business of trying to build smallish new settlements. And I think it's good that they are locally led. The problems are that, firstly, there's an experience problem. Most authorities have never done anything like this before. And, like, building a new town is quite a big deal. You know, compared to the level of power and resource in a typical district council, that is quite a formidable challenge. I mean, just keeping the staff in your planning department there for a decent length of time is quite a big challenge. Never mind building a new town. And the second thing is the law is just not set up to because of the history, is not set up to help them to do that. Compulsory purchase powers are kind of difficult to use and quite weak in a lot of ways in terms of allowing people to plead these huge hope values for their land. But more importantly, before we even get to the discussion about compulsory purchasing land, just the mechanics of purchasing land in the open market and then being able to sell that on an uplifted value, which I think is the more typical model, that's just not what local authorities are just not geared up to normally doing that, and they're not geared up to capture the value of it, and there's not really been much central support to do that. I think that's the thing that, that most needs to change there, because there's two alternatives for us. We can have development which is tacked onto every village and town, the edge of small cities, and that causes all kinds of problems, because when you do that, you're building in the places that people hate development most. It's the place where, you know, I moved to the edge of this village to get a nice view, and now I'm going to have a view of the back of someone's house. And it's, you know, every village gets overloaded, the little village school, can't expand because it's surrounded by houses, and so you build on the playing fields, and the little village school becomes overcrowded, and you don't get a new one because you're doing bitty development, 10 houses at a time. And that quality of development, though, is fantastically profitable if you're doing it, that kind of infill development, because you don't have to pay for the infrastructure. The quality of it is the most likely development to raise people's heckles, and it's just politically unsustainable. So we've got to go for, you know, programmatic development of new towns and new garden villages, because that's the only way to make the politics of this work, which is why every council's trying to do it. But then we've got to give all those councils a lot more support to do that, both in terms of changing the law to make it easy to capture the value that lets you do good development and good placemaking, but also just in terms of the capacity, the ease of doing it legally. So there's big questions like the fragmentation of transport planning and housing planning between counties and districts. So you could do a new nice town in a place that wouldn't disturb too many people, but then the county's in charge of deciding whether you get a new A road or not. Mm. And so there's a fundamental trickiness there which we need to solve. Maybe you have some kind of incentive where counties and districts cooperate on prioritizing what they want in terms of transport. I don't personally see a future in which we have sort of compulsory unitarization, because the politics of it, I think, just doesn't work. So trying to get the powers in place to do programmatic, properly planned development are crucial. And the same is true of town centres and city centres. There is a permanent change in the nature of our towns and cities. Retail space is just not going to be wanted in the same quantities that it's been wanted before because of the internet. We're just shopping online. Those town centres, those parades of shops, they're not going to come back. And there are some things you can do to make your town centre nicer. You can try and create the farmer's market, try and get more independent retailers, try and make it a bit of a destination. But at the same time, a lot of these places just need right-sizing. You need, if you've got a town centre, I mentioned before, I grew up in Huddersfield, that has an awful lot of charity shops and an awful lot now of voids, which weren't there 15 years ago. What are you going to do about it? You need to try and turn some of those into housing, I think, to solve one problem with another. But you're not going to do that just by liberalising. You can't just say, you turn this shop in the middle of a row of other derelict shops into a house. It's just ridiculous. You need to say, right, this whole street, this whole part of town is going to go to, urban living. Maybe we'll get some younger people in there, or maybe it will be, in fact, great retirement living where people can live in the middle of the town and shuffle to the shops, and, it's a great place for older people to live. And by the way, while we're at it, we can do something about these surface car parks. You've got Tesco with them, like acres of space around it, when if you were to make the car parking a bit taller, you'd free up a load of prime space in the middle of the town.
Indeed.
But you need a master plan to do that. It seems to me local government is the obvious one, but again, the local government would need an awful lot of help to do that. They're not in the business of doing that. They're not regeneration experts. Well, that's what I hope that Homes England will perhaps help with. It will be doing something a bit like the old English partnerships might do, but on a bigger scale, because there's, as I say, there's all these opportunities out there, problems that are opportunities, but we need the tools to help local government fix them.
We could definitely talk on housing and city centres, for longer, but I want to come back to get some further thoughts from you on the imbalanced nature of the growth. So you said you favour, in the report you wrote, you said you would favour a corporation tax coming down to kind of island levels, which is about 11 or 12%,
if I 12.5%.
But so that's kind of one, which is the playing field and how we then think about the attractiveness of international investment. You also then, through the analysis, say actually, in addition to that, your solution too, is to give some significant capital allowances, which will naturally preference or more naturally preference manufacturing capital intensive businesses, which typically, are they're not in the greater southeast in the same way as other types of firms are. So just give us a sense of your thinking on that, Neil.
So Britain has a well-known problem with underinvestment relative to similar economies. We have had fixed capital investments been lower than the OECD average in Britain in every year since 1960, apart from, I think, one. We've always had this problem about low investment, and that is one of the main reasons why we have this lower level of productivity in the UK. And there's probably a few different things causing that, but one thing that I think we've under-discussed is the tax system, because while relative to a lot of other developed economies, we're reasonably competitive on corporation tax. You know, we're not the most competitive. We're still quite a lot higher than Ireland, who are, you know, our English-speaking neighbours with a border with us. So it matters that they're more competitive than us. And that low corporation tax has really enabled them to hoover up huge amounts of inward investment. And that's one of the reasons why they've overtaken us in terms of incomes per capita. But the other thing that is a weakness in our tax system is that it's not very friendly towards capital investment. In fact, although we are towards the top in terms of the headline rate of corporation tax, once you include the not very generous capital allowances, which ranked 35th out of 36 industrialised economies, we're only really kind of mid-table. We've got a reasonably low headline rate, but behind it is not very good capital allowances. And actually that goes back to the point where we started cutting the headline rate. Lawson talked about broadening the base and lowering the rate. We actually made capital allowances a lot less generous as we started to cut, and we've done that ever since. We've been making them less and less generous. And that matters because, firstly, it means that we have, it's a contributor to low investment for the country as a whole, and that is one of the drivers of low productivity. But actually, there's a knock-on consequence for lagging parts of the country, because they're much more dependent on manufacturing for productivity growth. Manufacturing is much more capital intensive, and so those poorer regions are being much more hard hit by a tax system that is unfriendly to capital investment. So I think that if we were to do something about that, even if we just increase capital allowances across the board, that would be helpful in terms of having a more balanced economy and having higher productivity in poorer places. And actually, I think we should then go beyond that. We should use strategic tax breaks for capital allowances to attract inward investment, private inward investment, into those poorer places. So the classic example I always think is Mrs. Thatcher ensuring that there were capital tax breaks for Nissan to invest in Sunderland, which has just been a transformative thing for the economy locally. I mean, we did other things as well. They managed to buy an old airfield very, very cheaply. And, you know, a lot was done to make sure that they went in there, and that was great for that local community. And in fact, it was good for the whole economy. They were the start of inward investment in our car industry that brought a huge number of new ways of doing things, new technologies into it, and basically transformed the car industry from being a basket case to being a highly productive one. And so that is the sort of thing we should be doing elsewhere. We should be thinking about how do you create the tax and other conditions for really serious inward investments that can turn around poorer places.
And do you think that, you know, very modern businesses in the, you know, in the 2020s, as it were, are still as susceptible to or responsive to tax-based incentives as maybe they were in the 70s and 80s, or even, you know, into the early 2000s? I mean, what's your just reflection on that? Because you hear a lot, I mean, that is an element, but you hear an awful lot. I mean, this is another point you pick up in the report, increasingly about access to skills, you know, which is, again, one of our weaknesses, particularly in the adult workforce, right?
All of those things continue to be true. People want, you know, access to skilled labour. They want all kinds of other different things. They want decent transport, decent quality of life. All those things are true, and they always were. And I don't think that, you know, manufacturing is, it's in the UK certainly, a smaller chunk of the economy than it was. That's not to say that we can't attract in new high-end manufacturing. I mean, it's hugely important for productivity growth, because productivity growth in manufacturing is so much higher than in the rest of the economy. So it still matters hugely in manufacturing, but it matters in a lot of other sectors as well. When we talk about capital allowances, they're not just for investment in physical machinery. There's all kinds of other capital allowances that business groups have called for that are about the knowledge economy more generally. So, for example, the CBI, IOD and others have talked about broadening out from just having a narrow research and development tax credit to having something that covers the diffusion of new technology more generally, so that Britain's problem is not generally been inventing new things, it's been getting people to take up new technologies. We have a lower rate of automation and robotics than countries like Slovakia. I mean, we are really, really lagging. So I think that there are lots of other kinds of capital allowances that aren't just for physical things that we could introduce. But it's true, as you say, it's true that lots of other things matter, and devolution, the devolution process that we started in 2013-14 was partly about trying to address those other things. But the last thing I'd say just about your question is lots of other modern and very, very successful economies certainly think it's true that capital allowances are an important thing. You know, if you go to the websites of Invest in South Korea or Invest in various US states, you will see that these things are being dangled in front of you. And I guess there is a reason for that. And I just think we can't play cricket when other countries are playing rugby, because the people are, we're in a world of aggressive tax competition on these things to get these seminal inward investments, and we've got to be at least as good as those other countries in terms of what we're offering.
No, I agree with that. And you mentioned in the paper about that broader definition, and particularly can we and how can we treat investment in human capital and skills and wrap that up into capital allowance in order to address some of these, the trends seem to be unfortunately going in the wrong direction in terms of workforce investment over time, don't they? Particularly in the private sector, which would be a worry.
The amount of training people are doing in the private sector has been going down, which is one of the reasons why the apprenticeship levy was brought in, but we could build on that and go much, much further as well. Same thing at the moment is very true, actually. One of the reasons why we've had this productivity slowdown in the last couple of years is that there's been a sitting on people's hands. It's partly about Brexit and uncertainty and so on. But again, there's a problem and an opportunity there. If you could resolve the uncertainty and then give people a really powerful incentive to start investing in the UK, then we could really get somewhere, because there's a lot of decisions that have been deferred over the last couple of years and an opportunity to unwind that kind of slowdown in productivity.
I mean, the topics and the issues we've been talking about, I mean, your long-term commitment, the nature of my organisation, Centre for Cities, we're both heavily committed over the longer term to these sorts of questions and issues. Well, I mean, where do you think they currently are in the kind of national debate, and how do we maybe bring them back to somewhere near the top if they've slipped down over the last few years? I mean, what do we need to do to... for others to share in our enthusiasm and commitment.
Well, the number one thing you do is provide a brilliant solution that no one's thought of to Brexit. But joking aside, so that will get resolved at some point, and then a lot of these other issues will reassert themselves. And I think that we talked a bit about housing. I think that because housing numbers are running at higher numbers than they have before, the political pressures will be there. And in lots of parts of the country that are high demand areas, you just got to say to people, look, do you want all of the housing that's going to be built in this country to be in your high demand area, or do you want to do things that rebalance the economy, which will take the pressure off your train journey in the morning, your village, and have that growth spread more widely? When people think about it that way, the idea of rebalancing the economy becomes quite attractive to people in high demand areas. And in terms of the devolution agenda, I think that has stopped at a place that is at a very early stage. So we have done some things for the large cities. I know this is the Centre for Cities podcast, but there's a massive looming question about what we are going to do in terms of devolving powers to counties, less urbanised areas, and so on and so forth. That was meant to be the next step, and there's supposed to be decisions taken on that over the last 2 years. Because of everything, that's actually not happened. But whoever the new Prime Minister is needs to grip that and decide whether they want to be devolving more powers to local government.
Do you think
it's
the most urgent thing,
to be honest with you, actually, will be a discussion about local government finances, because a lot of them are, particularly counties with responsibilities for adult social care, they are in a lot of financial trouble at the moment. And so the first question will be making them decently funded enough to keep functioning as sort of forward-looking organisations. But then the next question will be, what are you going to do to make them, really drive growth? And what are we going to do? What is the replacement for the old structural funds going to look like? Mm-hmm. I think it's quite attractive to have a single fund rather than a British one and a European one. And we can imagine something that combines the best features of both. But you know, are we going to make that more generous? Is it going to have a particular focus on, you know, one thing or another? So lots of decisions are looming. I think the same is true on housing. It's become more apparent that housing is having this huge role in terms of increasing poverty, the cost of housing.
Yes.
And so I think that all those things will sort of come into focus naturally as people think about all the other things that are not Brexit.
And do you, is your sense that there's a kind of degree of inevitability, you know, in terms of, you know, answering and addressing those questions that you've just raised, but also, you know, the sort of slow march around, you know, devolution and more autonomy at the, you know, in a sense, we don't know exactly how it's going to play out. We don't know how long it's going to play, but are you a sense of, you know, that's the,
no,
the general trend, or do you, can you also see a possibility where
no,
we
no,
go
can,
back?
Yeah, no, I can easily see things stagnate, or go backwards or stagnate more likely. Or there's nothing inevitable about there being more devolution, and there's nothing inevitable about thinking that we might do things to balance the economy more, because the history over the last 20 years is the UK has become more of a two-speed economy with a capital that's pulling away from the rest of the country. That, in fairness, has been something that's happened in a lot of European countries, and more generally is the knowledge-based economy has really favoured the centres of cities, not even the outer parts of it.
No.
The outer London's not doing so great. The outer parts of places that are booming in the centre, Manchester, so on, are not doing as well. But places that, you know, towns that don't have a university, places that don't have any critical mass and are not, you know, places that people are moving to for their lifestyle, they're really struggling. It's hard for them.
But something will have to be done. I mean, in a sense, or do you not? Do you think we...
Something certainly should be done. It doesn't mean something will be done.
Okay.
And I think one opportunity which has been much discussed is this point that the Brexit referendum result was kind of like a disclosing tablet for showing which parts of the country people are not happy in, and the pattern follows pretty closely. Problems in the economy, in the centres of our cities that are booming, and the wealthier parts of the home counties and the wealthy parts of Scotland. Scotland is overall generally fairly wealthy. People vote to stay in, people voted to stay out where, you know, they felt like, you know, you didn't have anything to lose, or a lot of problems locally they were angry about. And obviously people were voting to leave the European Union. They weren't voting about something else. We shouldn't traduce what people were voting about. But people were more likely to vote for Brexit where they were already unhappy about the way things were going generally. And if that is not addressed, then we'll be setting ourselves up for a fall, because we couldn't have a brilliant Brexit and you can do all those things well. But if you haven't answered those, all those other problems that went along with it, then you'll have another explosion at some point in the future. So I think that it has brought all that into focus in a way it wasn't before. So I do hope that that will make people think and people talk a good game in terms of trying to rebalance the economy in a way that people were not very interested in it 20, 30 years ago. I remember, you know, the start of the Blair years, there was a great row about whether there was an autarch divide rate. It was getting bigger, and Tony Blair was sort of eventually dragged into saying that there was one. And I'm not having a go at him personally, but there's just a lot more focus on this problem than there was before, and I hope that people will deliver on the things they talk about. And funnily enough, you know, a lot of things have been set up in the last few years that will you know, make policymakers make a choice. Since the work we did in 2013 and 14, Transport for the North, for example, and their equivalents in the Midlands, have been hammering away developing these great plans for hugely transformed infrastructure, and they're going to crystallise in a kind of yes or no decision at some point in the next couple of years. So that will be interesting to see. I expect that there will be a lot of attention and commentary around HS2 and whether it will go ahead or not. Probably on balance pro HS2, though. You know, it's not the single most important thing that we could talk about in terms of rebalancing the economy. And there'll be lots of discussion about, you know, public transport schemes within our cities, which in a sense I think is smart, because I think intra-city transport matters a lot more than the amount of focus it's had. But, you know, the idea that the problems of an imbalanced economy are going to be solved by a tram here and a tram there is, you know, for the birds, it's not serious. And I'm a bit worried that there's not enough focus in the discussion on how do you get, how, do you do things in a way that we haven't before? And how do you change the tax system and those really powerful levers to get private inward investors to move to places that are lagging behind? And that involves doing things in a way we haven't before. And it involves some difficult decisions. When my experience in Whitehall was when you tried to say, look, you know, half of our science budget is getting spent in Oxford, Cambridge and London, you know, equivalent proportions of our housing budget, huge chunks of our transport budgets are in high demand areas, because the logic of the current funding formulas is you invest in transport where there's congestion, you put housing money where housing is expensive, and it's kind of like pouring petrol on a fire to put it out, or you saying you're only going to water the plants if they grow. There's a sort of circularity to it, and trying to break out of that, I think, is going to be a big deal for whoever is the next prime minister. And that does require a fundamental shift in the way that Whitehall departments think. The same is true in skills as well. The idea that we might have different types of skills investment or have programs that only exist in some parts of the country is just sort of anathema, really, to DfE officials, because it's, you know, got to have the same offer everywhere. There's a big argument to be had about all of that, but probably the mother load is doing things in the tax system, because I think we're so out of the habit of doing that, something we did for a long time, that would be a really huge culture shift at the Treasury in particular.
My guest today has been Neil O'Brien. Neil, thanks for being part of City Talks.
Pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner. Used with permission, and all rights are reserved.